Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. There's a lot going on this week in law enforcement. We have a great guest for you. But before we even go into that guest, I would like to talk to you about something that has been in the news and is very, in my mind, very unsettling and disturbing. So let's go to the interview room, and I'm going to give you my view from the blue.
The Briefing Room. Headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
I want to talk to you about respect of our nation, and how much it means to those who serve behind the uniform of the American police officer, as well as the uniform of the United States military. My parents were both World War II veterans, and I grew up understanding what they fought for and how their patriotism affected me. Tales of war are never pretty, just as many tales of law enforcement combat are not very pretty. But that is the reality of those who serve behind the badge and those who serve in the uniform. And many hundreds of thousands of people over the years have given their lives in sacrifice and service to their nation. Well, that includes thousands of law enforcement officers. The Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C. is a place that every law enforcement officer and every supporter of law enforcement officer should visit. I can tell you that it sends chills down your spine to stand and look at the thousands and thousands of names carved in the granite. And you will often see a survivor on that wall with a piece of paper and a pencil, and they trace the name of their loved one. And it's heartbreaking to see, but at the same time, it makes you fully understand the sacrifice that the men and women of law enforcement make. So when I saw Colin Kaepernick, that entitled punk of a football player for the 49ers, failed to stand up for his national anthem, the national anthem of our nation, and then give a public statement that the reason that he did not stand for that national anthem was because of the way the police are treating people, most especially black people, that there is so much injustice at the police are doing towards the black community. It made me sick to see it. Now, first of all, we all understand, everyone that has ever served understands the First Amendment of this United States and how important it is. Does Colin Kaepernick have the right under our Constitution to voice his opinion? Yes, he does. He absolutely does. But you know what? I also have my right, and you have your right to talk about how you feel and how I feel about what he did. What he did was show disrespect, not only to the men and women of law enforcement, but the men and women who serve our nation. I cannot help but think of those thousands of flag-draped coffins that have been flown into the United States from faraway lands, bearing the remains of men and women who gave all for their country. Just as I bring to mind the flag-draped coffins of the men and women that I have buried who have served this nation behind a badge. And what Colin Kaepernick did was disrespect all of those men and women and devalue their lives. I find it disgusting. I find it nauseating. I have no respect for him. I think he's a punk, and he's a grandstander, and he's a self-entitled millionaire who is now jumping on the racially motivated and agenda bandwagon for his own personal motivations. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, the President of the United States is in China giving a speech, and he brings up Colin Kaepernick. Now, if he had had the guts to say the right thing, he would have called him out on it. But instead, what did he do? He supported him. He supported him because, according to the president, he had valid points. What does that mean? That means that the president of the United States also has, which he has shown time and time again, has no respect for American law enforcement, has never had respect for law enforcement, and never will. As he gets into the final months of his presidency, he continues to show that disrespect. I don't know who's worse, the president of the United States or Colin Kaepernick, but one thing I can tell you, I have no respect for either of them. And that, my friends, is my view from the blue. I'd like to take just a moment to tell you about an organization that I am closely associated with. In fact, I'm their national spokesman. It's Blue Lives Matter. And Blue Lives Matter is a grassroots organization made up of law enforcement officers, former and retired, as well as active duty, as well as their families and just plain good citizens who believe in their law enforcement. This organization has a website, BlueLivesMatter.blue, which gives you all the up-to-date news on everything involving law enforcement. So come take a look at it, check out the news, and then like us on Facebook. You'll be glad you did. Before we go over to the interview room and I introduce you to my guest today, I want to tell you a little bit about him. His name is Greg Allen. He is the police chief in the city of El Paso, Texas. He's been a police officer for more than three decades. And I want to tell you about why I asked him to be on the show. He was in the news in a very dramatic way about a month ago after the assassination of police officers in Dallas. Now, Greg is a black man who is the police chief of a large city. And he was asked about his viewpoints on the Black Lives Matter movement. And he gave his viewpoints, all right. And what it did was it made the politically correct civilians who run that city absolutely lose their minds, and they called for his resignation. They called for him to be punished, and he stood his ground, which really got my attention. Well, not just a couple weeks later, I was having a couple cocktails with some El Paso police officers who were in Las Vegas visiting, and they were talking about their chief, and they were talking about him in ways that were really respectful, and how much that they respected him personally and professionally. And police leadership, in my opinion, is lacking greatly in many cities in this nation. So when I heard that respect level for this police chief, I said to myself, I think I need to have this man on my show. I reached out, he very graciously said yes, and you're going to have the opportunity to listen to what a real police leader has to say. Hope you enjoy.
You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. It's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. We invite you back to AmericaOutLoud.com to get all the latest. Make it a daily stop and also get the app. You go right to the App Store and download our free app, and that will put all our content right into your hands on your phones and your tablets. It doesn't get any easier than that.
The esteemed Chief of Police of El Paso, Texas, Mr. Greg Allen. Well, you've been in law enforcement. Tell us a little bit about your career.
Well, I began with the El Paso Police Department. I've been here 38 years right now. Started from the bottom ranks, which patrol officer, promoted after 12 years to sergeant. And then from there, lieutenant, after being a sergeant 4 years. And then I was brought to the chief's office by the former chief, and who is currently our sheriff of El Paso County, Richard Wiles, to deputy chief. And then from there, I promoted to the chief position, which has been actually the worst job I've ever had on the department.
You know, I believe that. How long have you been chief?
8 years now, going on nine this coming December.
Well, you know, for a life expectancy in that job of chief of police, I think you've exceeded it by about 6 years.
Yeah, I've heard that time frame too, and because I think it's 3 to 5 that I've heard, and I'm fortunate in that regard that I've had good people above me that supported some of the things I've done, and I think that's kind of critical for a chief to be able to do their job. But along with that statement, I think any chief taking on the position of police chief needs to be able to walk into the job one day, and if they have to do something contrary to their oath or what they think is right, be able to turn around and walk out on the same day of entering that job.
I understand exactly what you're saying. In fact, let's talk about that, personal stand that you took that that brought you into the national limelight just a few short weeks ago. After the massacre in Dallas, Texas, there was a great deal of attention paid to the Black Lives Matter movement, and there was a press conference that you were present at, but did not actually speak at, if I understand correctly. But then you were asked a specific question by the media about your stance on Black Lives Matter. Can you tell us about that?
Well, we were there. I went to that meeting on the request of the sheriff, who used to be the chief of the El Paso Police Department. I went to it to because he wanted to pay homage and respect to the loss of life of those officers in Dallas. And so I went there, and I didn't want to make a comment because I think enough was being said politically, but the county judge at the time made some comments that I thought were inappropriate for that time, because they start talking about the events of shootings by police in other areas of the country. And so that kind of left a sour taste in my mouth. But then when I was cornered about Black Lives Matter, it didn't take rocket science to figure out, because of their rhetoric, that they weren't friendly to the police. And with the pigs in a blanket, fry them like bacon, and what do we want dead cops when we want them now? To me, that wasn't a rocket scientist type of decision to be making as far as what their thought processes were and how they thought about police. And from what I understand about them, I think the country really needs to take a harder look at them, because their rhetoric is very volatile at the very least, and it's not friendly to police. And so with that being said, I felt very comfortable indicating if they've got a message to send, they need to send it a different way than talking about death to police officers.
Right. And as a result of that, you were shoved right into the national limelight because of the response of some of your political people in your own city.
Yeah, evidently I went against the party line, which is accepting of Black Lives Matter. And for me, I've got to be more practical than that. I can't be political in regards to what Black Lives Matter says as regards to how they view police. Because that would be to ignore reality that potentially could get officers hurt if I were to ignore it and look at their so-called message of wanting to bring some light or insight into so-called police violence against the Black community.
Now, the media, I mean, they did everything but call for your head on a platter. You know, as a sitting police chief and a law enforcement professional, how do you react to that kind of backlash from the media and from you know, literally the people that are in power in the political system?
Well, as I said earlier, I think a police chief needs to do what's right first rather than politically look out for their positions necessarily, because that's where they compromise themselves and where potentially they can do more harm than good if they compromise their principles for the sake of keeping their jobs. And I've always had that attitude. I've got 38 years in ADES chief, and like you pointed out, you know, I've had a longevity period that's outside the norm for a police chief. So for me, it wasn't something that was making me fearful of. I think I needed to say what I needed to say. Now, I've been told, supposedly, Black Lives Matter has factions in it that aren't necessarily preaching violence, but I go back to the days when I was growing up as a kid in the 60s and early 70s, where before Martin Luther King was killed, the mantra of his movement was nonviolence. And to me, if you're nonviolent, your message is going to be heard a lot easier than it would be if you're preaching violence, potential violence at the very least. And that's the difference that I see between the two. One group is talking hate, and going back to the time when I was growing up, you've got another indicator of how that message gets lost, or your idea of what needs to be corrected lost, if you're preaching violence and actually doing it.
And you know, I think that just for my listeners' edification, the fact of the matter is that you're a black police chief, and you're talking about a Black Lives Matter movement that is anti-law enforcement.
That's why I understand it from the intelligence and just the open source media. If the media is being fair about it, I think most people will come to that conclusion, you know, that they're not friendly to police. I understand they're not friendly to the military. They're actually not friendly to the workings of the federal government. They want to defund policing. They want to defund the military. And I don't see how people can come in and support that type of mantra when they're making those types of comments.
It is unbelievable to me. I don't know if you caught the headline the other day, but they have just been funded. This blows my mind. They have just been given $100 million.
Yeah, I understand George Soros has provided that money. And, you know, there's something going on in the country, and I think it's the wound of racism having the wound reopened again, because there's just a racial divide in the country, and it's getting deeper and deeper. And for me, that's problematic, because with the election of President Obama, at the very least, that should have been an indicator that the country's moved forward beyond the racial color concern to elect a president who happens to be black, but being elected with not just the black vote, but across the color spectrum. And that has been lost in what's going on currently.
I couldn't agree more. And you know, let's talk a little bit about, you know, you've been in this game a long, long time. You've seen the bad old days and some of the good old days. You know, as I began my career in the mid 70s, and there was, you know, I remember that there was implicit racism within certain police agencies. I mean, you know, I grew up in an affluent town, very liberal, Princeton, New Jersey. But even joining the Princeton Police Department in 19, I had really never heard racial epithets until I actually joined the police department. And then, you know, the N-word was tossed around, you know, pretty freely at that time. And I tell you the truth, it kind of shocked me even as a young man, because that wasn't the way that I was raised. But, you know, it got to the point where it almost – It was so often that it didn't have the impact that it had prior to for me. Now you came up during that same time period. How was the racial attitudes towards you as a young black officer?
Well, it wasn't predominantly as open as you described in your particular instance, but it still existed. You know, there was a few guys here on the department that you knew were racist and so forth, and because you were blue, though, they kind of looked at you as being accepted because you were wearing the same uniform as them.
Right.
And those officers have gone by and retired and moved on and so forth. So it's a lot different now, because we've got a younger group that have come onto the department, and the racial concerns that probably would have been in place way before I even joined the department have been removed. In fact, there's history of the department here where the black officers that first came on the department in the 50s and even before that were taken to the black areas of town, and that's where they policed. And some of those officers then made reputable names for themselves among their counterparts, their white officers and Hispanic officers in this city, and the reputations they earned start opening the door even wider and wider, to the point where today, as a black chief of the El Paso Police Department, you know, that is no longer a concern or an issue, to the point where it has to be considered before giving someone a job.
You know, I saw an amazing metamorphosis during my 33 years as a police officer. You know, I told you that you know, at the beginning of my career, I saw some implicit racism. But as time went by, I mean, I don't think in the last 20 years of being a cop, I ever heard a police officer refer, you know, use the N-word in a conversation. And I saw that as a pretty amazing metamorphosis within the career field.
Yeah, you know, this country has been founded by men. And with men founding the country or creating the country, however you want to look at it, there has to be the realization that the human being himself is not perfect. And so with that being said, the country had its founding doctrine in place, the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, and it's moved into that with people who had power realizing things weren't perfect and realizing that made those changes over time that allowed the country to move forward to where today we have a black president. And, you know, that is the thing I've always seen. When I grew up, I remember the things like Lyndon Johnson doing as far as moving civil rights forward and so forth. He didn't have to do that. He could have let that die with President Kennedy's assassination, but he didn't. And he moved it forward because he saw the suffering of minorities in different parts of the country and how that needed to be rectified. And him being the president now, he had the power to do so. But the question still remains, or the statement still remains, he did not have to do that. He did it because he saw wrong and he made those changes. And so the people that we try to demonize today as being the people that are the problems are the ones that made the changes. In El Paso, there was a situation back in 1962 when I was not allowed to go in a movie theater here because it was only for Hispanics and whites at the time. And
really?
A white guy.
That's interesting. Hispanics and whites.
Exactly. Hispanics and whites. And there was a professional here by the name of Bert Williams. He was a lawyer. In fact, he was one of the city council reps at the time. A friend of his, who's probably nationally known as a basketball coach, Nolan Richardson, was refused service at a restaurant. Well, his buddy, Bert Williams, the white guy, said, you know, this isn't right. And so he went and changed the city ordinance to allow blacks into restaurants, into movie theaters, any place that other people had access in for blacks as well. For me, that was a statement, again, because it was a white guy that made that change. He didn't have to do that. He could have said, hey, Nolan, that's just the way things are. But he didn't.
Right.
He took it upon himself because he saw wrong in his mind and made it different. And I think that's what a lot of blacks who are younger than I am don't appreciate, because they don't appreciate people who had the position, had the authority, had the power, made those changes. And I think that's what a lot of our political leadership don't do today. They're too concerned about the next election, and they don't look at doing what's right because it potentially might cost them that position that they so relish at that point in time.
Exactly. No, let's talk about El Paso just for a second. It's a very diverse city. I mean, you're right on the border with Mexico. And,
right.
And you have, how big is your agency?
We've got It's actually smaller now than when I took the job. We should have, if you look at other cities, probably about 1,500 officers. Right now we're working with about 1,035.
Wow. So you guys are really understaffed.
Really understaffed. And the problem with that is that, you know, we've been successful in fighting crime here. And I think to a large degree, we're looked at like any other business. We're looked at, why hire more labor when you're doing great with what you've got?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's the trappings of success, right?
It's a double-edged sword.
Now, Bean, you know, let's talk about police leadership. You're in a major city, and you're part of the Major City Chiefs organization, correct?
Yes, sir.
Well, so you interact with police leaders from all over the country, and one of the things that I've written about extensively is police leadership, and sometimes the lack thereof, because it seems to me that there has been a movement in police leadership to really take a very, what's the word I'm looking for? A stance that is more based on the safety of non-committal to real strong leadership in order to stay in their jobs longer. And so they take a very political down the middle, instead of doing the things that are backing their police officers in times of need, which has led to a real drop in morale in police officers around the country.
I agree with that. You know, it's kind of disheartening because, you know, if any position can suffer the consequence of doing what's right, it's the police chief position. You know, they can they get what they want, the government leadership over police departments, by manipulating the chief to a large degree, and I've seen that. Fortunately, I haven't had that consequence imposed upon me. I've had good support over the years here, and I think that's one of the reasons why I've been able to stay in the job the length of time I've been able to stay here. But with that being said, you know, it's kind of scary when I sit in these meetings because it seems like they're more concerned, different chiefs, about their position and keeping that position than doing what's right for the community. And I really take my oath of office serious. In other words, defending those things that you swear to when you originally become a police officer should be paramount in most chiefs' minds, but I can tell you it's not. Whatever mantra or doctrine the leadership of any chief working under is having to follow, that becomes his mantra if you want to stay in the job.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that doesn't always help the community that police department is trying to serve. Like right now, I'm a big supporter of the Second Amendment, but when I go to these conferences, they're talking about we got to get rid of the guns and we've got to get rid of high-capacity magazines. You know, law-abiding people aren't going to be the issue. It's going to be the person that takes that weapon and uses it in a malicious way. That's the way I look at it. It's just simple reality. We can't look at the gun as being the problem because we've got evidence or proof of that in different cities like Chicago, where they have the most stringent gun laws in the country, yet you have a murder rate that is making that city the capital of the country, potentially.
Exactly.
And I just see the difference there and how, you know, all of a sudden the political tone gets changed instead of really looking at the actual problems that confront a jurisdiction.
You know, having been in office as long as you have had, and watching the changes take place within the political environment, how has that changed the leadership of policing in the major city chiefs or in that not necessarily that organization, but in the chiefs of police as a whole? The political situation has changed radically since President Obama took office. How have you interpreted that change?
It seems like it's following the Democratic line now, because most of the people that are following that seem to be the larger departments, And a lot of people get into the groupthink. They don't want to be the naysayer. They don't want to be outside of being considered a player with the rest of the team. And so you have people like me who come from a smaller department, allowed to play in the game, but not being big enough to have a significant say, so to speak. But I get enough lip service to say what I need to say, but that's as far as it goes. And so with that being said, I don't have the influence some of the other departments have, and it's just simply a lot of times because I'm not one of the major players. When you saw the president's task force, it's got Charles Ramsey on it from Philadelphia, a bigger department, an East Coast department. And if you look at some of the players, I didn't get an invitation yesterday to that meeting that they have with Hillary Clinton. Not that I will have gone anyway. Yeah, it's one of those things that, you know, if they were really interested in hearing it, it shouldn't be just with a handful of chiefs when there's quite a few departments that might have wanted to hear what you had to say, especially since the attitude that I saw during the Democratic National Convention was a lot different than what she supposedly said yesterday in the news conference.
Yeah, or, exactly.
Talking with those police chief.
You know, I want to talk about your vision of leadership for a moment. You know, the I have communication with police officers all over the country, literally every day, and I've seen a real deterioration in not only the personal morale and the professional morale of officers around the country, but a longing for strong leadership. Now, you came up through the ranks, so you worked with great supervisors, and you probably worked with really bad supervisors and understood the difference. What is your personal leadership philosophy?
Well, I don't forget where you came from. I think it's one of the bottom lines on that, because the real working of the department that makes it function across the country, where I believe it, is actually the street officer. And that street officer is the one having to deal with the hostilities, the political issues that might confront them out in the streets from various incidents that occur, from a protest march to a murder to whatever else. Those officers are having to deal with that. And they need the support of knowing, if I'm doing my job and I do make a mistake, I shouldn't be made an example of because I was trying to do my job. Yeah, there might be some type of discipline that has to be imposed because I really messed up here. But to make an example of them is as far as this is what not to do or else this is what's going to happen to you is not the philosophy I live by. It wasn't done to me when I came up through the ranks, because I've had people that would chew my behind off of my body, but at the same time, leave me with the dignity that I was doing a good job, but don't do that again. But now it seems like, okay, if you make a mistake, we've got to make an example of you to send the message that this isn't the way to do things. And if it happens to be really something serious, you're really going to pay the price with possibly a loss of your career. And I just see that more and more. And a lot of people who are chiefs, I see sometimes they follow the dictates of their bosses. And then when the heat is really turned on, they're one of the first people who will be thrown into the mix as well, as far as who's going to lose their job.
Exactly.
So it makes me wonder whether or not they feel that their loyalties were betrayed. And so to me, I think you have to be able to look in the mirror every day at yourself and do what you have to do. Not that you look forward to disciplining officers. That's one of the most distasteful things I've had to do in this job, is disciplining an officer that was trying to do his job, but do it in a way where they learn, but you still keep them on your side to go out and still work hard.
So you're talking about mistakes of the heart, as opposed to, you know, mistakes of the mind.
Exactly. Yeah, and you have to look at it like that. I mean, there can be, for instance, the dereliction of duty incident that you have to deal with. But then you have to ask yourself various questions. Did we train this individual? Did they do it because they were lazy? Did they do it because they just didn't know? Did they do it for whatever reason and find out all those particulars behind it and then make your determination? Because if you fail to train someone and now you're accusing them of dereliction of duty, well, that's not their fault. That's the department's fault. And yes, so you have to look at things from a wide range of perspectives. I kind of look at it like the bullseye of a target. You got to look at the peripheral rings around the bullseye before you make a decision that seems so obvious because you're only looking at the bullseye. You need to look at those peripheral rings because sometimes that drives the decision you need to make more than the actual problem you're looking at.
That's a really, I like that metaphor. That's a very good way of looking at a leadership perspective on dealing with the issues of discipline. You know, there was just an incident up in Northern California, and it made some headlines, but not really big. A sitting sheriff canceled an officer survival class that was being offered by Caliber Press. And of course, you're probably familiar with Caliber Press and the quality of the training. But because certain people in the community came out and criticized that officer survival training as being, well, it might make our police aggressive, this sheriff came out publicly, denounced it, and canceled the training. Now, I don't know if you heard about this, but that really, to me, that spoke volumes about how that sheriff cared less about her officers than she did about the politics of that training.
Yeah, that's unfortunate because, you know, when you're looking at, okay, we don't want our guys to become aggressive, you know, that kind of goes back to this new thing that the major city chiefs were talking about the last time I was with them about the warrior versus the guardian.
Yes.
You know, the warrior, that may have negative connotations with certain people, but the warrior is the one who sacrifices himself because he's the one actually doing the fighting. And that warrior concept is ill-placed with some of these people because they think that automatically that means we're going out and we're looking for trouble, that we wake up and put on our uniforms every day looking to go kill someone or beat someone up rather than going out for the warrior mentality, the way I see it, as protecting people, going in harm's way to avoid the weak and the innocent from being victimized. And that, for me, is the warrior, because they're the one who suffer the consequences of taking on the battle.
Exactly. I see it as exactly the same way. And I find it very disturbing and distasteful when I see, quote, police leaders, unquote, that are basically sucking up to the 21st century policing model that's being shoved down the throats of police agencies around the country.
Well, yeah, I totally agree with that, and I think that's going to hurt law enforcement because you're going to find a smaller and smaller pool of people that want to do this job, and the people that do go into it are going to be subjected to lack of support as far as leadership, because I think we're only as good as the people above us. And when you have that not in place any longer because people are politically looking at themselves more than the people they're responsible for, then we're going to see the community suffer. Because when people don't want to do this job any longer, it's going to be a loss to the community, because a lot of people look to their police departments to protect them, or law enforcement in general. And when that is going to be done in a mediocre type of way, then the person that needs us is the one that suffers.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Well, we're running out of time here, but just before we go, what would you say to the police officers and those who support them that are listening to this broadcast right now about the future of law enforcement?
Well, one of the things that I've seen as something drastically different from my day and age is that there's a camera everywhere. And depending on what film footage is shown, you can either look good or you can look bad. So my suggestion to people is do the best job you can. really consider this profession before you really get into it, because I think it's going to be one of the hardest jobs to do in the future if this political environment we're working in right now continues. And I think that needs to be considered before someone actually does it. And make sure you know your policies and procedures well, because that is the first step that allows someone to get rid of you when you step outside of policies and procedures. Because as long as you operate within those policies and procedures, the department has to stand by you. The moment they can find that little crack in that armor of yours, in some cases, you'll be the first to go.
Right, exactly. The sacrificial lamb for political purposes.
That's exactly right, Randy.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. Your insight is really helpful, and I know that you are a very, very well-respected police chief within your own organization and nationally as well.
Well, thank you for saying that. I just hope I can live up to that praise.
I think you already have. You got 38 years in.
All right, Randy.
You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. Well, it's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. You'll find a whole host of shows and a lineup of great content back at AmericaOutLoud.com.
End of watch.
Each week on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we honor those who have passed away in the line of duty. Unfortunately, this week, there are two line of duty deaths to report. The first is police officer Clint Corvinus of the Elmer Gordo Police Department in New Mexico. Police officer Clint Corvinus was shot and killed during a foot pursuit of a subject in the 600 block of South Florida Avenue. He and a rookie officer that he was training had conducted a traffic stop of a wanted felon. The man fled on foot during the stop and exchanged gunshots with the officers. Despite being wounded, Officer Corvinus was able to return fire and killed the suspect. Officer Corvinus had served with the Alamogordo Police Department for 4.5 years. He is survived by his daughter and his parents. His end of watch, Friday, September 2nd, 2016. The second police officer who died in the line of duty this week was Austin Police Department Police Officer Amir Abdul Khalik. Senior Police Officer Amir Abdul Khalik succumbed to injuries sustained 4 days earlier in a police motorcycle crash. He was providing an escort for a funeral and was attempting to reach the next intersection when a car attempted to turn left through the procession. The car pulled directly into his path, causing him to strike it. He was transported to the University Medical Center, Breckenridge, where he remained until succumbing to his injuries. He is a U.S. Marine Corps veteran, has served with the Austin Police Department for 17 years. He is survived by 5 children. Police Officer Amir Abdul Khalik, Austin Police Department, end of watch, Sunday, September 4th, 2016. Each week, we hope never to put another name on this memorial. I want to thank you so much for tuning in to this week's episode of Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I hope that you enjoyed our guest. I hope that you enjoyed my view from the blue. I'd love for you to follow me on Facebook, Randy Sutton, public figure, and also on Twitter at Lieutenant Randy Sutton. Follow us on America Out Loud for a wide range of excellent programs in addition to Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I'll talk to you next week. Stay safe.